now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is an old friend, Neil Cruz. Neil is the host of the Neil and Larry Show. He was born in Carmel by the Sea in 1950. Neil received his BA degree in humanistic psychology from Sonoma State University and promptly proceeded to fall head over heels in love with architecture. No universities would let him back in for architecture, so he spent the next 10 years becoming a general building contractor and started Origin Design and Construction in the Aeneas Cannery on Cannery Row in Monterey, California, a company responsible for hundreds of projects on the Monterey Peninsula. A designer of homes on the peninsula for almost 40 years, Neil also took several years to focus specifically on interior design. In the 80s, he created the Homecoming Seminar Series, a three-part public workshop dedicated to exploring the psychological aspects of homes and all forms of architecture. The seminar was presented on the Monterey Peninsula, Fresno, and a special presentation to the Psychology Department of Sonoma State University. In the early 90s, he was elected chairman of the 2016 committee, a committee appointed by the City Council of Carmel to create a vision for Carmel for the year 2016, its centenary. The report was requested and read by cities around the world. Currently, he designs homes and commercial interiors and works with groups and communities as a facilitator and group organizer to help them achieve their goals and become free from the controls and restraints that arise from within groups due to control issues. Neil is an old friend from California. He was one of the original members of the Dragon Slayers, and there's a lot of great alumni from the Dragon Slayers days. Wes Penra, many of you listening are familiar with Wes Penra's work, Laura Leone, Eve Lorgan, Tom Montauk, Andrew Hennessy, who was a former guest, myself. So Neil was a former Dragon Slayer. And so without any further ado, Neil Cruz, how are you?
Very good, James. Thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be on your show with you.
Thank you, Neil.
I just want to say to the listeners that I hold James Bartley in very high regard. I would like to, James, just have a few seconds at the end of the show to say why, but I want the listeners to know that this is a man that we all need to be paying attention to, listen to his shows. You're going to find some of the best material coming from this man anywhere out there on the net. There's a lot of us that are researching a lot of different issues, and James and the people that he works with are at the top of that group. So you're not going to find the expertise that you're anywhere else that you're going to find on this show. So I just wanted to say that, James, and you know I mean it. And this is very nice of you to invite me to do this. And I was kind of curious in the beginning, James, like, why would you have somebody on your show to talk about community? I know our past was about many subjects involving, I guess, what people would consider conspiracy theory. You know, all this stuff that they feel is not real because we're not taught about it in college, that all of that comes under the title of conspiracy theory. And then people just let themselves think that none of that is real, I don't have to worry about it, and they don't want to get messed with these alternative systems of knowledge. But when I began to work with community, which is something I wanted to do for a very long time, I found conspiracy theory and the subjects that it's not theory at all, it's conspiracy fact, that without going there, I never would be able to understand community the way I do today. It's just not possible. And James, you know what I'm talking about. There are so many hidden influences, hidden, secret, invisible, that affect us, that affect our communities, that affect our society, that affect the individuals. And if we are not going to look at that, if we are not going to talk about it, if we're not going to be able to take it into account, we are never going to have good communities.
Absolutely. And that's the principal reason among many, but the primary reason I'm going to have you on today's show and in future shows, because the word community is misunderstood by a lot of people. Now, from your perspective, from your point of view, knowing that conspiracies are real, knowing that there is this top-down, pervasive, malign influence that does everything possible to thwart real communities, tell us your terms and your perspective. What is a community, and why should we talk about community?
Okay, the subject of community must invariably be about people working together with each other in a group. You know, co meaning with, and then you have unity. Now, when human beings, when you consider them as individuals, let's say you've got a guy living on a mountain and he never interfaces with anybody, well, that's one kind of life. But for most of us, we come into a family. And then as we grow up in that family, we hopefully have brothers and sisters, and then we are meeting the families that surround us in our neighborhood. And so now we go from the individual to the family to a group of families. You also have the extended family. For example, you have children. Your children have children, which are grandchildren, and then they have children, great-grandchildren, and that tree spreads out beneath you, and you have your own sort of family community. So community is about people working together with each other, people working in groups. And it's very interesting because it's a whole different animal, James. It's almost like if you think about wolves and pack behavior, that when wolves get together in packs, there's a whole behavior that kicks in. It's automatic. It's a survival instinct. I have a client, and they have five dogs, and they told me that every now and then they go into pack behavior with a leader and the followers. And so it's the same thing in the human family. Group behavior is a whole different animal than individual behavior. Many of us don't think so, but it is. When people begin to work in groups, you have many dynamics that come into play. And the essential story on the world front, more or less, is that you have this fight out there between, well, you could just to simplify it, the good guys and the bad guys. And the bad guys are largely that group that wants the collective to have control. The collective must have power over the individual. And the good guys are saying, no, the individual is sovereign, and the collective must never control or stifle the individual. These are the two big camps. And Marxism and communism leading the collective camp, and capitalism and democracy, the individual sovereign camp. Now, these two ideologies, obviously, we're greatly oversimplifying the political ideologies that run the planet, but these are the two basic ones. And so when humans get together, they create a civilization. You know, we have to have a way to build houses and a way to do roads, and what kind of vehicles are we going to drive in, and what kind of communication systems are we going to have. And then this creates a society and a culture. When, for example, when we're thinking about culture, we think about the influences, the millennial generation, Generation X. What are the belief systems that these groups have? What do they consider the norm in terms of lifestyle, this sort of thing? So it's a huge, vast subject. And understanding how groups and communities are controlled, and how the dark side gets involved in this equation is critical if we're ever going to have really good working communities.
What I've seen, Neil, is that in our field, the UFO research field, the paranormal field, the conspiracy research field, people think in terms of the community we're in, the UFO community, but there is no community. What we see, just to use the cite an example of the UFO field, which I'm very familiar with,
yes,
is you see all these factions, you see all these egos and empires, you see all this infiltration, disruption. The Ford Foundation and the CIA have for many years have sent out, have trained and groomed what they call community activists. But really, these people are community wreckers. Instead of going to communities and unifying people, what they do, what they specialize in, is finding little insignificant trivial things to argue and fret about. They create factions. They get people all worked up over things which ultimately have no consequence or no bearing on the future. It's all about divide and conquer, Neil.
Yes.
And so that's what I see in the UFO field. We hear the same thing from the Sasquatch, Bigfoot community. Or we even hear it from the near-death experience community, where you have this one camp that says, oh, there are no negative, hellish experiences when people pass over. They only remember going to the light and having good experiences. And this creates a field for which a lot of disruption and interference can be inserted.
Yes. And divide and conquer, James, it's interesting to hear that you're seeing it in those fields as well. I always kind of knew divide and conquer was part of the process, but the more I have studied what is ruining communities, I have now moved the divide and conquer game to the top of the list as almost the first thing they do and the thing that they do the most. I like to refer to, let's say that you're watching a movie on TV and there's a bunch of bank robbers that have moved into a bank, and you know they've got everybody lying on the floor and they're taking control, and there's some guys back in the vault getting the vault open and they're loading up the bags with money, and some smart person, one of the bank officials that's really clever, is lying on the floor and he's got one of the guys near to him, and he whispers to the guy and he says, hey buddy, are you so sure that your guys back there in the vault, you so sure they're not going to leave you here? Oh, they wouldn't do that. Shut up. Stop talking to me. And then that guy tries again. And he says, well, think about it, you know. They've got to split that money up with you. That's less for them. You know, he could just get out of the vault out the other end, leave you here to take. Stop talking to me. And so what that bank teller or what that bank official is doing is very subtly applying divide and conquer into this group of robbers. And it starts with just creating a doubt, just building a scenario. You know, those robbers, they're all comfortable that they're doing this together and they're all going to come out of that bank together. But if you're smart, you can put doubt into that guy's mind. And then he begins to no longer trust the other partners. Now they no longer work as a unit, and then you can begin to turn them against each other. So that same method is used in communities. It's used against the family. And as you're saying, James, it's used against all kinds of research communities. And another example that is less obvious of divide and conquer, I read an article by a guy talking about political correctness and all of the new gender categories that our universities are providing us with. People might be familiar with the term cisgender, and then we're supposed to have different categories that do not denote men and women as separate from each other. And then there's something like 25 different sexual categories that you can put yourself in. I think the list is 25 long or 30 long on Facebook now. And so the guy said, this is all divide and conquer. He said, political correctness, the backbone of political correctness is divide and conquer, creating one little segment of society and saying you should be angry at the other segment of society. And so by having 25 gender classifications, it atomizes, it breaks up society into more and more subgroups. And so you will hear these people say, I am a cisgender, flaming such and so, lesbian, yada yada. And they'll have four adjectives to define their sexual orientation. Well, now you don't have just men and women anymore. You've got all of these different sexual subgroups, and then you can have some of those sexual subgroups be insulting other sexual subgroups. So again, divide and conquer, divide and conquer. People putting themselves in ever smaller groups and classifications so that they can be angry at other groups and classifications. So political correctness and these gender terms, one of the reasons for them, not the only reason, is divide and conquer. The essential, when you read Karl Marx, he says, we must destroy the family. And in so many words, I'm not sure that I've got the exact translation, but he's very open about that. We have to disrupt the family as we know it today, because he said we're sending the wrong message to our children in the conventional male-female relationships that we're having at this time. And it has to do with gender superiority and gender relationship and so on. But what Karl Marx isn't saying is that the stronger the family is, the weaker the state is going to be. And so the whole idea was that, in my core idea about the family, nobody socializes the child but the parents. And what is socializing the child? When you bring sex education into school, you have preempted the parent's role. And now the school is becoming the parent. No sex education. This is my preference, you know, none at all. And then also religious preferences, you know, you can now hear in the American school, they're beginning to be kind to Islam and they're beginning to be brutal to Christianity. Hey, what the heck is that stuff doing in our school system? You know, so we're teaching kids about Islam in school. If you want to teach the essential characteristics of the Islamic faith, along with the essential characteristics of the Christian faith, along with the essential characteristics of the Judaic faith, of the Hindu faith, of all of these faiths, in the same way, to the same degree, without saying that one has preference to the other, without saying we're going to take down our flags because it's insulting the Islamic contingent in the school. If you want to do it that way, I say fine. Now it's education. You're broadening the understanding. That's not what is happening. They are favoring Islam in many of the schools. They're saying this is what you should learn. Learn to really appreciate. And then when the students say, when are we going to learn about Christianity? They'll say, oh, we're not. Because Christianity is insulting to Islam. So here you can see already there's something going on. Somebody is influencing our youth. Somebody has decided that there is a message we want our youth to have. And so you get all of that stuff. Religion, that again, is for the family. It is not for the schools. Schools should have nothing to do with that. I think we said in this country we were not going to... We were going to let people choose whatever religion they want, freedom of religion. By the way, I do not accept Satanism or Luciferianism in that description, personally, at all. I do not accept those two groups in any way, in any shape, ever, period, you know, no discussion. The Satanists and the Luciferians, they want themselves to be considered equal to other religions. They're not. They're horrific. So I exempt those from that class. But if we want to teach our kids all about the different kinds of religions without preference one over the other, I'm fine with that. But when it comes down to, hey, kids, this is what I want you to believe, or this is the religious understanding I want you to have, or this is the spiritual understanding I want you to have, that is the parents. None of that in the schools. And so divide and conquer. It starts with the family. We have to break up that family, because as long as the families are strong, the state has less control. If you have a very strong, look at the problem that the Carolinas are giving to Obama's programs with the transgender bathrooms and with different school policies in the Carolinas, and they have been very resistant, and they have told Obama, we're just not going to do it, and Obama says, well, we'll make you do it. In the Carolinas, you still have really strong families. You also have very strong Christian families. Okay. Now, I'm not, you know, people get to choose their faith in this country. You do not get to force Christianity on them, force Islam on them, force Judaism or Hindu. People get to choose. That was the whole point of this country. You don't bring that debate into the schools. That's for the parents to discuss and to work out with their children. So this divide and conquer works at every level. It destroys the individual, it destroys the family, then it destroys the neighborhood, and then it destroys the municipality. Always, always, always trying to break up the cohesiveness of community so that people will depend upon the state for their security, the state for the education of their children. And that's what Marxism is attempting to do. Let me stop there. There's a lot more on divide and conquer, but I let you in, James, to see if there's anything you want to ask about that or any particular direction you want to pursue.
Yes, thank you for sharing that, Neil, because those are key points. By destroying the family and inculcating this blind obedience into the children to look to authority figures, this is what Common Core is all about, folks. It's like it used to be 2 + 2 = 4. Now you have all these parentheses, you have all these subgroups, you have all these different columns, you know. It used to be just 2 + 2 = 4, but they overcomplicate things. It generates this learned helplessness, and it inculcates this, it basically drives them crazy, right? Because there's no logic or reason to it, but it's an example of this insane psychopathic system imposing its will on these kids, right? Where, say, if the kid goes, that's not how my dad showed me, that's not how my mom showed me, it doesn't make sense, there's too many steps to come up with a simple answer, you're wrong, how dare you, you question us, you're being nonconformist, you're expressing oppositional defiance disorder, they even have names for these things now.
Yes, these are psychological malfunctions now.
Exactly, and then therefore they fall under the rubric of psychological treatment, Ritalin, ADHD.
Yes.
So they have all these things kind of defaulted and set up where if the kid tries to express any creativity, any originality, any divine source manifestation of source, that's going to be stomped down. That's what communism was all about, what Marxism was all about. It's everyone is a collective. Everyone is equal at the point of a gun. And the thing about the family, too, Neil, it's so critical that you brought that up. Because, and people can look this up. Look up the United Nations Charter on the Rights of the Child. Like so much that's out there, everything is an oxymoron. Everything has a double entendre meaning. What the United Nations Charter of on the Rights of the Child really means is that from birth, and now increasingly they're talking about when still in the womb, but anyway, for our purposes, from birth, the child is automatically a ward of the state, and the parents have little or no say in the upbringing of the child. And this is all codified in all these white papers by all these think tanks, by all these United Nations, UNICEF think tank groups, etc., etc. They've been talking about this and pushing this agenda for a long time because, as you pointed out, Neil, a strong family unit and a strong identity within the extended family and throughout the community, that makes it harder for the state to interrupt. And what the state is doing and has been doing, Neil, is in the issue of health choice and health advocacy, they've completely undermined the role of the family. They're saying, oh, you don't want your child to undergo all these unnecessary chemotherapy treatments, radiation, vaccinations, we're going to take your kid away from you because you're a bad parent.
Yes.
And so that's what it's all about, a fragmentation. It's all about what the scientists called entropy, right, where as organisms and constructs become more complex, they become more chaotic, and which is the vast backwards opposite of of real nature. When you look at a microscope, at a water molecule, or a snowflake, you see all this order. You see everything in a sacred geometrical fashion. But the way that these collectivist communists think is everything that it doesn't respond to our control systems is chaotic and has to be stamped out.
Exactly. And that is why you now have students in wide reporting of this, students in, well, grade school, junior high, and high school, that are ashamed when they excel. They actually feel bad about it. And this is not entirely new phenomenon. This has been going on for more than a decade, where the schools are, you know, that's really good that you did so well on that test, Jimmy, but, you know, think of how you're making the rest of the class feel, you know? You're going to make them feel inferior when you do that. And don't you want them to feel included? You know, so there's this message that comes out through the Marxist systems of collective control that people who excel are renegades. They're defiant individuals, and they're actually damaging the community. The idea that the rogue thinker is the problem. You know, James, I used to watch a lot of movies. Now I only watch them at home on Netflix. But to get a sense of the social shifting that they were doing through the Hollywood system. And I was watching all these sports and dance movies, you know, the dance competition between this group and that group, and the parquet competition, and the football, and the hockey team, and all these stories. And I said, why are they showing us these stories? They all seem to have the same message. And just like in one day, it just hit me all at once. In all of those movies, the message is the same. The team is failing. Why? Because the leader has gone rogue. He's doing his own thing. He's just thinking about himself. You watch these movies, you're going to find that theme coming up over and over and over. The team leader who won't play along. The guy who thinks he's better than the rest of the team. And he's destroying the team, and we're losing the competition because of this one jerk that refuses to fit in with the group. Well, he finally breaks down, or, you know, he does something terrible, and he realizes he's being a giant jerk. And then he comes back into the group and says, I'm just going to do what all the rest of you are doing. I'm no longer going to excel. I'm no longer going to be different. And then they win the big game. And so this message of individuality is bad is everywhere, in the media, in Hollywood, the movie, the Lego movie, everything is awesome when you're part of a team. Everything is awesome when you're part of a team. That was the big Lego movie that made this huge splash. And if you watch the Lego movie, at one point, he finds all these superheroes and geniuses and stuff. And they're not doing any good. Why? Because they're all individuals. They won't work together. And so what does the hero do? He brings them together into a community. Everything is awesome when you're part of a team. And the reverse of that is everything is horrible when you act by yourself. So when you start to look for this message, you see that we are being bathed in it. And so no longer does that high school student want to do so well. He's afraid to. He holds himself back. No longer does that college student want to get those high marks coming out of college, because he's afraid that he is dissing and hurting his friends by excelling. And so you destroy that, I want to do well, I want to do better, I want to do the best I can do. You got to destroy that. And that's what Marxism does. To try and simplify these concepts, James, what I say about Marxism, it's kind of a saying, that Marxism is about blame, guilt, and shame, and victimhood. And to simplify that, Marxism says we need a homogeneous humanity to rule over. Ants, basically. You know, that's what we want. And now we've got all this very difficult stuff to do. We got strong families. These communities are really strong. You try and insert a new method into their school, they're going to rise up because they have their own values. We got to get rid of those values there. And so Marxism takes the capitalist system, which says, hey, if you excel, buddy, you're going to get more money, you're going to get more credit, you're going to get more goodies. Why? Because you worked harder. Why? Because you're better at it, and you deserve better because we're going to acknowledge you for your skills, for your abilities. We're going to reward you based upon that effort that you've made. And then everybody wants to do better. That's the beauty of competition. Hey, I'm going to beat him next time. No, you're not. I'm going to beat him. That drives you to do your best. And then when you excel, and this is the way it should work, when you excel in an organic capitalist system, we don't have organic capitalism right now, but when you excel, then the people around you, yay, you did great. We're really proud of you, man. You showed us the strength of our group by excelling as an individual. So that individual is rewarded for that. And then when he goes on to his job or he goes back to his community, he is empowered to do more. He is empowered to show his greatest abilities. And Marxism wants to get rid of that. And so it uses blame. What Marxism does is it takes all of the lesser elements in society, the elements that are generally not as prominent or well off. So it's going to look for any of the classes in society that may have trouble being accepted, like, for example, the homosexual and gay population. And this was actually the idea of Herbert Marcuse, who was in the Frankfurt School. And he said, those would make some good victims, don't you think? Those would make the gay population. That's a great group of victims. How about the African-American population? Good class of victims, you know. And how about women? Hey, haven't they been trounced on by men forever? Yeah, there's another really good class of victims, you know. So now you go to the victims, right? And instead of saying, hey, you guys, we want to help you do better. We want to help you become strong inside of your own groups and so on. No, you say, you know what? The reason that you people are less than, the reason that you're not at the same level as everybody else, it's because of those people at the top. It's because of those smart people in the colleges. It's because of those people who do better than you. It's their fault. You see? They're doing it to you. They're taking away from you by doing so well, by excelling, by becoming extraordinary at what they do. They're hurting you. And so they tell the victim class, you need to take them down. That's that horrible 1% that is imprisoning everybody. You need to take them down. Let's tax those rich people at 99% because they don't deserve that money. They stole that money from you. We might remember the Obama speech. You didn't build that business. Somebody else did. Are you out of your mind, Obama? Have you ever built a business? It practically kills you, and now you're saying you didn't do it? So it's sheer insanity. But this is the whole idea behind Marxism. It's basically a psychological algorithm is what I call it. What Marxism does is it says, let's blame everybody that excels. You know, one of the enemies of Marxism is the white male, right?
The white male.
Because white males have done so well. But how did they do well? They did well by stealing it from you. That's the only reason they did well. They're really good thieves. It has nothing to do with their ability.
You know, a quick story. You know, back when I was going through the college brainwashing, not really, because I used college for my own purposes, Neil. I used it to go study abroad. I used it to go, you know, read books in all these different libraries, stuff that I was interested in. And I used to always fill out these forms for student loans. Thank goodness that I was never accepted for them because I'd be up to my eyeballs in student loan debt. That's another bubble that's waiting to burst.
My God.
You have all these overeducated people with degrees in English literature, but they're only qualified to do some menial tasks somewhere. Nothing wrong with menial tasks. They need to be done, you know, in a non-robotic age, and you know, so far we're in a non-robotic age.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
And I figured out why I never got these loans is because it's my name, James Bartley. It's like they never scanned further down the application form to see what my ethnicity was, right?
Uh-huh.
It was like, oh, James Bartley, it's some white privileged guy. It's like he wants money that he didn't earn. And so I always got rejected. I figured it out after all these years that if I'd had like a Southeast Asian name, or yes, if I had a name, like I came from Somalia somewhere, they would have given me the house and the lot next door. And another thing that's interesting too, it's funny how spirit puts you in positions, Neil, over the years, because we were just talking about like businesses and Obama's refrain of, you didn't build that. In other words, it all belongs to the collective, right?
Right.
Because small business and medium business were always the backbone of America, always. That was the whole purpose behind the educational system created by the oxymoronically titled American Historical Society, was A, to rearrange, was to lie and change history, and B, to bring in all the people from the countryside and get them into the cities and get them into the factories,
yep,
because it was the dawn of the industrial age. You get them away from the family farms, you get them away from, this...
Yes.
Kind of agrarian lifestyle where they knew how to make campfires, they knew how to fish, they knew how to be self-sufficient, right?
Right.
So you build all these people up in your own image of being like a mindless drone. You bring them in from the country, you wipe out the small and the medium businesses through taxation, through legislation, through zoning rules, over and everything that militates against a small or a medium-sized business, which was the backbone of America. And then what you have is you have corporate control,
yes,
being exerted through all these like social justice warriors, through all these collectivist, hive-minded Marxists in the universities at all levels of society. Now that we have all these hive-minded, these Marxists and these collectivists, they don't even know what they are. They really don't even know what role they play. They're just these disaffected masses that fell into that victim category. Right.
Right.
Where they were suddenly empowered. You think about all the social justice warriors out there. These guys were nobodies. They don't even have an original thought in their heads. Everything they know or think they know came from someone else. Right?
Yes.
And so they're being turned loose on all these people. All these people with white privilege.
Yes.
Oh, all these people own their own, businesses. They're the ones that are the problem. Whoever, and also Webster Tarpley, he wrote this book, I forget what it's called, The Unauthorized Biography of Obama. He wrote two books about Obama, and one of them he talks about how Obama was originally a community activist, but in reality, as Webster Tarpley points out, he was a community wrecker.
Yes.
He goes into these communities, and instead of finding things to unify the people in order to get them to make a difference for themselves, he finds these community wreckers are trained to zero in on these specifically divisive subjects,
yes,
and themes, which
yes.
disunify. They don't unify, they disunify. They fragment, they atomize.
Yes.
And that's what it's all about. And also I see how that's crept into sports, right? Because only in America do you hear these comments from professional sports athletes, from professional coaches, from sports writers. Oh, that other team, they were showing us up. They ran the score up on us. They were scoring too many points. Well, you know what? Don't let them score points,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's what having a defense is all about. Oh, yeah, they ran up. They were stealing bases on us when they're up by 10 runs. I've seen baseball teams come back from 10-run deficits. If a team scores 10 runs and a team scores 11 runs right after, the team that scores 11 runs ain't going to give those runs back. And this notion of, well, they're showing us up. Well, stop throwing pitches down the middle then. Hold the base runners better. Stop complaining. Only in American sports I see this, Neil.
Wow,
nowhere else do I see in all these other sports this concept of, oh, they were showing us up. They were running the score up. They were being unfair. They're being ungentlemanly. Well, don't let them score then, right?
Wow.
And another thing that I've seen too, where two of the three main American sports, and increasingly in baseball, and I say this from a sports standpoint, there's a lot of people that bag on those who like sports. I see it as a pleasant diversion, although I see all the social engineering, especially from ESPN these days, right?
Uh-huh.
But to me, it's a pleasant diversion at times. I'm not in the NFL gridiron the way I used to be, because it's all social engineering. It's all mediocre. And the same thing with basketball. It's all mediocre. I mean, I was into those sports in the glory days, in the early 70s and stuff. And what I see in professional American football, to differentiate from all these other sports called football around the world. And also in the National Basketball Association is, it seems like a horde of lawyers got a hold of the rules, Neil. Uh-huh. Because like in American gridiron in football, it's like there's so many time stoppages, there's so many play stoppages, there's so many infractions, penalties, this, that. There's commercial timeouts where the official on the field will call a timeout to allow these television ads to play, right?
God.
I mean, so if you're at the game, you're just watching a game, next thing you know, timeout, and nothing's going on. And that lasts for 3 or 4 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, the play starts again. But, again, incomplete passes, penalties, marking off yardage for penalties. And I realized what that was all about, Neil. It was to fragment the minds even further of all the viewers, to get them conditioned to stop, count off a five-yard penalty, right? Okay, resume play, run the clock again, run out of bounds, stop the clock. And you have things like timeouts.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, it's like completely different from all these other sports around the world. Where I've watched games, like in Australia, they have a National Rugby League, which is kind of it's similar in a way to some like rugby games, but it's very physical and very violent. I've seen two players flopping around on the ground with injuries. They don't even bother calling timeout. It's like play on.
Really?
You know. So the guy just laying there flopping around injured, who cares? They're going to keep playing, right? Whereas in American sports, and now in baseball, it's increasingly become fragmented. Because the whole concept, it used to be the starters would pitch the whole nine innings, and even if you know the starter lost, he would be in there at the end. Nowadays, they have middle relievers, like lefty one-out specialists to go after one left-handed specialist. They have, like, a whole boatload of specialist relievers, and that takes time. Okay, you got to stop play, you got to bring a reliever in, you got to take a reliever out, you got to do this. And it's like everything is designed, it seems, to fragment the consciousness of the sports viewer. And then when you watch, like, EPL, like English Premier League, it's fluid. It's like end-to-end. They just keep playing. There's no timeouts, right?
Yeah.
But everything is designed to fragment the consciousness, create this kind of whiny kind of athlete and sports fan. Oh, they were running the score up on us. Well, mostly it's because your team sucks. You have no defense, and you don't know how to play. That's what that's all about. Right.
Yeah.
Johnny can run faster. Get over it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. And it's really interesting to hear this side of it, James, because it just further convinces me that this is at every level. It saturates almost everything we do in this country. And now you're talking about another form of entertainment. It certainly is in the Hollywood movies. It certainly is on the TV. And so now you're saying it's in the sports. And you know, when you cannot follow that game with all these breaks and stops and conditions and so on and so forth, it pulls you out of the feeling, the overall feeling of this process and your identification with the players and seeing the spirit of the game, because you're stuck in all these broken segments. You know, you don't get that overview. And this is just another form. When you look at the regulations that we deal with in, say, building and zoning and so on, there are so many that it's just a gigantic process to get through the paperwork that you even forget about the integrity of the design. You know, because if you can just get those all of those permits and use permits and get through all the meetings, you've done well enough. To heck whether it looks good or not, you know, you're so consumed with the process, you lose the spirit of what you're doing.
Well, we're going to have a lot to talk about, you know, in the second half, because it was important for the listeners to understand where all this fragmentation, entropy, this Marxist collectivist, reduce everyone to the lowest common denominator mindset came from.
Yes.
Because it's important to contrast that with what a real community is all about, Neil, because I got distracted from what I was saying earlier, but it's interesting where spirit moves you and puts you in places over the years. Like, for example, I used to work in a Section 8 housing in San Diego, right? Here I am.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, here I am. I live in a matchbox studio, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's like, okay, too much information, TMI, but
You can cook.
You can cook breakfast and sit in the bathroom at the same time. That's how small this place was, okay? And it's funny also how you experience reverse discrimination, because my buddy, who at the time ran the San Diego UFO Society, he was in a property management, and, you know, I was at a loose end. I needed a new place. My lease was up. I was living at the airport, Neil, and it's like, oh, my God, the walls would shake. I would look out the window, and I would see the undercarriage of these planes, right, out of my second-story window, and the walls would shake. It was a nightmare, so my lease was up. Okay, you know. Yeah. And so my friend said, oh, well, I got a place up here. It just became empty, and turns out to be this little, you know, studio. And it was smack bang in the middle of a gay community, a gay enclave in San Diego. Uh-huh. And, you know, here's a disclaimer. You know, I've known and had a lot of gay friends, a lot of lesbian friends, some of the most wonderful, lovely people I ever met, right? So don't push this homophobe crap on me, yeah, right? Yeah. Some of my own family members, some of my own extended family members are gay, okay? So people get over that, right?
Right.
But anyway, so here I am, and I wind up in this little studio efficiency. And then my friend goes and sells out that property to a couple of gay guys, right? Uh-huh. And the gay guys begin systematically raising the rent on all the heterosexual people and couples and heterosexual singles. So they're moving out, right, one by one. Eventually I moved out, right, because we were all discriminated against. Mm-hmm. And what was ironic while I was living there, and I lived there for 7 long years, Neil, and went through all kinds of crap as far as ET experiences and other things were going too. But I remember the irony of being in Section 8 housing. And there were people I was pre-approving. I was ordered to pre-approve all these people that were immigrants that didn't even have a Social Security number, that they would come over into the U.S., have a baby, and from that moment on, okay, the moment they had a baby, they couldn't deport the woman because the woman, the child, was automatically a U.S. citizen, and you couldn't separate the child from the mother, yep, from the baby, rather. And so they started getting all these grants, right? And you know what? I was just saying, and this is what I told myself, I'm not mad at these people. That's the way the system is. It's a mass influx of immigrants, and since that time, of course, they're bringing in all the Wahhabists, Salafists, radical Islamists to go and rape and pillage and stuff. They're a protected species, and don't bother complaining about that because that's racism, right? But right, this is before all that. This is when they're bringing in the Somalis. And what's interesting, Neil, also is you can look back, and all the places that America intervened militarily, there came an influx of refugees from those war-torn countries, Southeast Asia, Somalia, everywhere where the U.S. invaded, usually on quote-unquote humanitarian grounds, suddenly there was an influx of refugees from those places. So here I am, I'm living in a little matchbox studio, I'm pre-approving all these people because I'm ordered to, that's my job, right?
Yeah.
And they don't have a Social Security number, but somehow all these people and their extended family qualify for all these grants. They're not even loans, Neil.
Really?
It's like, and they were moving in to places far better than I lived in. I lived in a little matchbox, right?
Yes.
And these people are moving into 3, 4, 5-bedroom places, all taxpayer-subsidized, of course, because in the collectivist scheme of things, it's, you know, they parasitically feed off the people that are actually generating income and, you know, generating movement in the economy, and then they turn around and it's a massive transfer of wealth. And so, you know, here I am, all these people, all these immigrants from all these different countries, and I'm barely making ends meet. I'm living in a little matchbox studio. I just thought it was ironic, Neil, that, again, Spirit put me in a place where I can see, you know, in crystal clear fashion how the system is set up.
Wow. Almost like you were being educated.
Absolutely educated. And it was interesting how many grants, how many different bonuses these people qualified for. Like, they make it so hard for native-born Americans, and forget about what they've done to the Native Americans. They're still persecuting them. But just like your average, like, Anglo-Saxon white person, let's say, it's, you know, forget about getting a business started. That's out the window. They don't even teach how to start, expand, and sustain a business in business school in America. As you know, Neil, it's all collectivism. They teach people
That's
in the
correct.
Business schools either how to be an employee, a servant of a corporate master, or be one of those fast-climbing, you know, claw-your-back type of, you know, corporate, you know, shakers and movers. Those are the only types of people that the business schools kind of cater to, is the minion, or they look for these people of the right bloodlines, the right mindset, the basically sociopathic narcissists that would be ideal in a corporate setting.
Yeah, it's just literally massive. You've got the whole millennial situation, and in the millennial generation, which I believe is born at 1984 and later, 67% of the millennials are not in a serious relationship. And I was listening to a gentleman, I can't remember his name, but he does a lot of talks on business and economics and succeeding, and he did a talk on the millennials, and he said, they have been destroyed by us being too easy on them. And when we used to raise children, we wanted the children to be challenged. We wanted them to confront difficulties and have to master them on their own. And then came this new wave. No. Just tell them they're so special, you know. And even when they come in last in the race, they still get an award, you know, a participation award.
Yes, that's right.
Again, you can see this Marxist influence again. We don't want you to excel. We want your merits to be based on the fact that you belong to the group, not your own individual abilities. And so now we have this millennial class that basically can't have families, can't have children. I had a conversation with one of them 3 weeks ago. I'm not saying it's typical of the millennial group, but I said, what do you want to do in life? And he said, well, you know, I want to quit smoking. And I said, no, I mean, you know, what do you want to accomplish in this life? And, well, I don't know. I think, you know, I'm thinking, Neil, about getting a woman pregnant so that I can have a kid. And I said, well, wouldn't you marry her? You know, maybe have a... No, I don't want to do that. Uh-uh. That family stuff, that is not for me. I just want the kid. This is the way they think, you know. So we're not going to generate happy families. The ones that do create families that are steeped in that millennial consciousness are going to produce more millennials, you know. So we don't have here we have the fracturing of the family. This comes out of the cultural entrainment process in our colleges. But we, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on. What about autism? James, you may know something more about where this is coming from, but in Vaxxed, V-A-X-X-E-D, the movie on vaccines, a very qualified expert said in there that, not sure of the year, I am sure of the percentage, that 2030, 2035, 2050, as I say, I'm not sure of the year, she said that 80% of American male children will be autistic. 80% of our youth, the males, will be autistic. There's another person with a similar statistic like that. It's not baloney. We're down to 1 in 45 when it used to be 1 in 10,000. Okay. This system is manufacturing autistic children. Part of it,
oh, yes,
is, again, to destroy the family. Autistic children, they're now celebrating the corporations are hiring all these autistic children. Isn't this so wonderful of us corporations that we're now beginning to hire these autistic children? The corporations created the autistic children.
That's right, they did.
Autistic children. They make great human robots, and they work so well alongside of the machine robots. You know.
Without complaint, too. Without
no
dissent,
complaint.
Without complaint. And another thing, too, Neil, and we're going to go over this first hour because, you know, we're on to some serious topics. Because I was thinking back to my childhood, Neil, and I want you folks, okay, that are out there, the over 40s, let's say, right, and the over 50s. I remember distinctly, Neil, my fifth grade class, and they were already, you know, starting to do all that social engineering, but a lot of the kids were still under the beneficial guidance and tutoring and mentorship of their elders, you know, their parents, their grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, of course, in a TV show, as parents and older people are routinely made to look stupid and frivolous and
right.
vacuous and empty-headed.
Exactly.
But back then, I think about my fifth grade class. It was a split fourth and fifth grade class. Most of the boys played chess. A lot of the girls played chess, and they were very good, too. I mean, all you got to do is look at their openings. Oh, she's opening with this, she's opening with that. It's like, you know, they had all the continuations worked out in their mind. It was like you were in for a battle against these kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then a lot of us were into, like, history. And although, you know, we had kind of basically, you know, a shallow understanding of military history or history in general, we were still somewhat well-read because our elders were well-read. Our elders,
yes.
our parents, our uncles, our grandfathers
yes.
would sit around reading things called books, and they would tell us about the past, and they would tell us about things that had happened. And so I distinctly remember having discussions in the fourth, fifth, even the second grade, Neil, where we're talking about the Roman Empire, we're talking about ancient history,
yes.
we're talking about Atlantis, we're talking about UFOs and flying saucers, right?
Wow.
Because we hadn't been completely dumbed down. They hadn't been stamped out of us yet. And another thing, too, is with this common core, and then, you know, there's people like, well, there's so many researchers out there that have done great work about common core and educating for the New World Order, is that they not only they teach nonsense and dribble specifically to drive the kids crazy and to create a learned helplessness and obeisance and obedience and acquiescence in the children, add on top of that the Ritalin and everything else. But the teachers are ordered to teach to the test. So if the teaching is
yeah.
2 plus 2 equals 6, and you have all these commas and parentheses and all these, you know, all this other extra Common Core crap on it, that's how they teach it, right?
Right.
So if the kid in the margin goes 2 plus 2 equals 4, oh no. Because the teachers have to teach to the test.
Yes.
They have to teach the way that the instruction manuals teach, and that's passed on to the children.
Yes.
And another thing, too, is what I've seen with the military. Now, with the military, there's always been an element of conformity. This goes back, you know, countless millennia, because, you know, the foot soldiers have to be trained to think and carry out their commands unthinkingly. They can't be saying, well, why am I doing this? Because I might get killed, right? They have to follow their orders in an autonomic, almost robotic fashion. But what they've done on top of that, Neil, is, and this is particularly true of the U.S. military, which, you know, all the romanticism aside, all the Band of Brothers crap aside, as far as, you know, professionalism is concerned, the U.S. military is so far behind. Like the British, the Australians, all these other different, the Russians, as far as military professionalism is concerned, is precisely because of this watering down, homogeneous mass, we're all the same kind of BS. Like, for example, in the U.S. military, just about every branch wears a beret. In the old days, a beret meant you had to earn it. You had to, like, do something. You had to pass, like, SAS selection or something before you got your beret.
Sounds
nowadays,
excellent.
Everyone's got a beret. Like uh-huh. like the invasion of Grenada, which was just more bullying, actually. But there was only about 8,000 troops involved in the entire task force, in the entire operation. They gave out over about 20,000 medals, right?
Yeah.
For like a handful of troops, everyone got a medal. And nowadays, in the American military college system, you have what the late Colonel David Hackworth calls "I was there" medals. When someone sees on TV, like a general, like testifying before like a Congressional Appropriations Committee, and they see that whole kind of row of ribbons on their chest, those aren't combat decorations. Like this ribbon was for attending the Industrial War College. That ribbon was for going to the Air War College. That ribbon was going, you know, for getting his bachelor's degree, right?
Uh-huh.
It's not for, like, the reason Napoleon instituted the medal system was to honor valor, right? That was the whole purpose behind it.
Yes.
Right? Because he knew he'd get more out of his troops that way. Now what you have is they're just giving out medals in the military for anything, you know, participation medals. And they're doing it now, like you pointed out, to kids. We're like everybody, there's no winners anymore.
Right.
There's no right. Sally was the fastest runner. Johnny was the fastest runner. Everybody gets medals. Everyone gets awards.
Yes.
They've all been reduced to this homogeneous, undifferentiated mass. It's what they've done to the Germans, Neil. Because history teaches us that there were no good Germans. There were all evil Germans. So when you watch these modern war movies, right? The Germans are infantry are always depicted as this undifferentiated, gray, homogeneous mass with their officers barking out these guttural commands, right? And that the Germans are depicted as robotic soldiers. On the contrary, the German soldiers in World War II were taught that every soldier from the private on up was trained to be able to take command two echelons above whatever their rank was. So a private should be able to do what a sergeant does. A sergeant should be able to do what a lieutenant does.
Yeah.
And it's completely top-heavy in the Army, like in Operation Anaconda, which was a relatively small handful of troops from all these different nations in Afghanistan. General Tommy Franks from MacDill Air Force Base was giving orders down to the company level through teleconferencing, right? So this would have been unthinkable to World War II era commanders, where a theater commander is giving orders to like companies and battalions and regiments. It just, everything is a complete inversion. There's no individuality. This is why the U.S. military, despite all the wars they get into, has disaster after disaster after disaster, and why Hollywood always spins out these disasters into heroism. Oh, the few against the many, against insurmountable odds, Neil.
Yeah.
When really, if you study the campaigns, it was like a disaster in planning, operationally. Everything about it was a disaster. It was designed to fail. The wars are designed to go on indefinitely.
Yeah.
And I can go back to World War II, and I can point out individual campaigns that were designed to fail, to stretch the war out, to give the Russians time to move in from the Eastern Front.
Yes.
You see, it's all designed to reduce everyone to the same homogeneous, undifferentiated mass, the way they depict the German soldiers in the movies.
Yep, that's a very good point. And they don't want the differences between men and women either. So they tell us, as they did when I went to Sonoma State University, it wasn't in a class, it was in a study session outside of class. They have many of these study sessions, and I went to one on gender, and the woman starting the group said, let's start out by all agreeing that the only differences between men and women are through and created by the process of socialization. There are no innate differences between men and women. And so I was just brave enough to say, really? I mean, have you looked at a woman's body and a man's? That doesn't matter. That's the body. And who are you? And why aren't you listening to me? And I said, well, it just seems kind of silly to say that there's no differences between men and women. In other words, they set that as the premise to the meeting, and then they drive everything to that conclusion. There are no differences. This is the homogenization. No differences between men and women. And there should be no differences between the best student and the worst student. And then you've got the hive mind. You've got 1984. You've got the obedient population, the ant population, the slave population,
the pharmaceutically influenced population on top of that.
No,
never mind. And look how they depict I say this over and over again, but it bears repeating, Neil. The male in cinema and in TV shows, they're depicted as weak. They're depicted oftentimes effeminate, that they don't know which end of the hammer to hold, what I call the Will Ferrell archetype. And you look what they do to all these leading male actors, right? And there's no telling what they made these guys go through behind the scenes so they can become world-famous leading male actors. But look at another thing also, Neil, which is part and parcel of all of this, is the vulgarization of society, what I call the vulgarization of society. You and I, we grew up in an era where Saturday Night Live was counterculture. It was like, hey, we're doing our own thing. And people could say, oh, you know, the whole CIA control of drugs. Yes, I got that. I know about that, okay? But when you watch the original Saturday Night Live, A, it was really funny, and B, it was somewhat risque, too. It wasn't over the top, though. It wasn't vulgar. Now, when you watch Saturday Night Live today, which I don't, I haven't watched it for years, it's all vulgarity. And what they do for every male leading actor, who is the host for a given Saturday Night Live show, is it's a ritualistic humiliation, Neil. They make them act in one or more skits where they're a flaming, effeminate gay guy without calling them gay. They did it to Ben Affleck. They do it to everybody. That's another thing, Neil. When we fill out a job application, I'll take the bone you're throwing at me, $9 an hour, squeak, 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 right? Like a mouse. Why doesn't someone fill out a job application? What's your expected hourly rate? How about $90 million, right? You want 8 hours of my time, right?
Yeah.
You want me as a crisis actor to shout anti-Trump slogans? Give me $1 million and then I'll do it, right?
Right.
Because I'm not like all the others, and don't treat me like all the others, right?
Right.
So that's where we're at now. And so, folks, anyhow, we've reached the end of the first hour, and, Neil is an old buddy. Like I said, he's a dragon slayer, right? He's a dragon slayer.
Yeah.
Wes Penra, Laura Leone, Evie Lorgan, Tom Montauk, Andrew Hennessy. We had a great bunch in those days. And this is long before social media.
That, James. That was a great group.
Yeah. Those were the glory days in many ways. And so we're just getting started. In the second hour, thankfully, we're going to talk about solutions. We're going to talk about what it takes to build a real sustainable community, not the crappy Agenda 21 sustainability, but real sustainability, how no matter what goes on in society, if it goes pear-shaped or not, we're going to be able to survive and flourish, okay? So we've reached the end of the first hour. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Neil, what is your website?
It is neilandlarry.com, neilandlarry.com. And this is where we have the recordings from the radio show that Larry and I have done. And a lot of it is about green architecture and so on and so forth. And Larry had to go, so I'm in the process of converting it to the Neil Show, NEALshow.com. In the next 30 to 60 days, it will probably go to that. But I'll have a redirect from Neil and Larry. So if you just remember neilandlarry.com, that's our website.
Yes, folks, and there's an archive on there. You can listen to his previous podcast where he talks about a variety of issues, about community building, proper community building, how to deal with zoning issues and all that stuff. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.